This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, we're wrapping up the year with a series featuring some of our most entertaining interviews from 2010. Up next, we have our interview with Jay-Z, who's been incredibly successful as a rapper and an entrepreneur. He was born in 1969 and grew up in the Marcy housing projects in Brooklyn. He watched crack cocaine destroy his neighborhood, but he sold it on the street before he found his new life in the recording studio and on stage. In his book, Decoded, he offers his story as an example of the story of his generation, explaining the tough choices they faced at a violent and chaotic time. Decoded also tells the stories behind 36 of his songs. Jay-Z holds the record for most number one albums by a solo artist on the Billboard 200. He co-founded the label Rockefeller Records with Damon Dash, as well as the clothing company Rockaware. He's the former president of Def Jam Records. He's a part owner of the New Jersey's NBA team, the Nets, and co-owns the sports bar, the 4040 Club. Let's start with his recording with Alicia Keys, Empire State of Mind, from his 2009 album, The Blueprint 3.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm out that Brooklyn. Now I'm down in Tribeca, right next to the Narrow. But I'll be hood forever. I'm the new Sinatra. And since I made it here, I can make it anywhere. Yeah, they love me everywhere. I used to cop in Harlem. All of my Dominicanos right there up on Broadway. Pull me back to that McDonald's. Took it to my stash spot, 560 State Street. Catch me in the kitchen like a Simmons whipping pastry. Cruising down A Street, off-white Lexus. Driving so slow, but BK is from Texas. Me, I'm out that Bed-Stuy, home of that boy Biggie. Now I live on Billboard, and I brought my boys with me. Say what up to Tata, still sipping my ties. Sitting courtside, Knicks and Nets give me high five. I be spiked out, I could trip a referee. Tell by my attitude that I most definitely from
New York. Hey. Jay-Z, welcome to Fresh Air. It's great to have you on our show. What were your first rhymes like? You got your first boombox when you were 9. Your mother gave it to you. You say because she thought it would help keep you out of trouble?
Just so, you know, if I was focusing on music, you know, I wouldn't be, running the streets all while. So she tried to encourage me to pursue my dreams in music early on. And my first rhymes were pretty much, you know, very boastful and, you know, academic, but they were kind of advanced for a young kid. Like, I put a piece of one of them, and it was like, I'm the king of hip-hop. The renewed like the Reebok, the key in the lock with words so provocative as long as I live. And I look back on that rhyme now, I'm like, man, that's pretty prophetic.
So you were about 9 when you wrote that?
Yeah, between 9 and 11, those are my first rhymes.
Would you describe the Marcy Projects in Bedford-Stuyvesant where you grew up in Brooklyn?
Yeah, you have these three columns of buildings with four people on each floor. Six floors, you know, so you have people to the left of you, right of you, top, on top, and on the bottom of you. It's a very intense and stressful situation. Everyone's going through different things. And in between all that stress and angst and, you know, having to deal with one another in such close proximity, there's so much love, and there was playing in the Johnny Pump, and there was the ice cream man who coming around, and there was all these games that we played, and then it would turn suddenly just violent, and there'll be shootings at 12 in the afternoon on any given day. So it was just weird mix of emotions. I mean, you know, one day your best friend could be killed. The day before, you could be celebrating him getting a brand new bike. It's just extreme highs and lows.
How old were you when crack came to the neighborhood?
It was about 85, so I had to be a little earlier than that. So maybe about 12, 13 years old.
And how did that change the projects?
Well, I think what it changed most was, you know, they have a saying, it takes a village to raise a child. It changed the authority figure because, you know, with crack cocaine, it was done so openly. And the people who were addicted to it, the fiends, had very little self-respect for themselves. It was so highly addictive that they didn't care how they obtained it. And they carried that out in front of children. who were dealing at the time. So that relationship of that respect of, you know, I have to respect my elders, and, you know, Uncle Tyrone's coming. He wasn't really your uncle, but he was the uncle for the neighborhood. And, you know, that dynamic shifted, and it had broke forever. And it just changed everything from that point on.
And it changed everything for you, because you write about this in the book, and, you know, you've rapped about it too. You ended up being a hustler. You ended up selling crack. How did you start doing that?
Well, yes, it wasn't very difficult. It was like
no job interview. Resume.
Yeah. I knew a friend who knew a friend, and, you know, he made an introduction, and we had a conversation almost like a job interview, and it was almost these rules of how to do it and how not to get high on your own supply, and how to be a man of principle and of your word, and dealing with people. And it was like this advice as if it was a Fortune 500 job, you know, except it was, you know, crack cocaine.
So you describe in the book how when you first started writing rhymes, you had a notebook. But when you were hustling on the street, you weren't carrying your notebook with you. And if a rhyme came to you that you wanted to remember, what would you do? You'd go to the store. Tell the story how you'd go to the store to...
Yeah, what happened was I wrote so much in this book. I would sit at my table for hours and hours till my mother made me go to bed. And it was like this obsession with words and with writing. And as I got further away from that notebook, you know, as I was on the street and these ideas would come, I would run into the corner store, the bodega, and grab a paper bag or just buy a juice, anything just to get a paper bag. And then I write the words on a paper bag and stuff these ideas in my pocket until I got back. Then I would transfer them into the notebook. And as I got further and further away from home and from the notebook, I had to memorize these rhymes longer and longer and longer. And like with any exercise, you know, once you train your brain to do that, it becomes a natural occurrence. So, you know, by the time I got to record my first album, which was I was 26, I didn't need pen to paper. My memory had been trained, you know, just to listen to a song, think of the words, and then just lay them to tape.
And what about now? Do you write down rhymes when they come to you, or...
No, I haven't since my first album.
And your memory's as good now as it was then?
Yeah. Yeah. I've lost plenty of material. It's not the best way. I wouldn't advise it to anyone. I've lost a couple albums worth of great material. Well, I thought they were great.
Well, if you're just joining us, my guest is Jay-Z, and he has a new book called Decoded. So how much money had you been making on the street when you decided to try music?
Well, I don't know if you really have a concrete number of how much money you were making. Sometimes it was really good and it was fantastic. I mean, I did pretty well, which made it more difficult for me. Because at the time, people in the street were making more than rappers. You know, not until the big deals of Master P and Puff deal with Bad Boy with Arista Records, were people getting really big deals. So for the most part, people in the street were making more than rappers. So for me, I address this in the book as well. There's a song called Can't Knock the Hustle, and it sounds like I'm saying you can't knock my hustle. But who I was talking to was the guys on the street, because rap was my hustle, and like at the time, the streets was my job. So when I was telling people, yeah, I want to be a rapper, I want to do this, they were like, man, why do you want to be a rapper? Those guys get taken advantage of. Everybody takes their money. You know, we go to parties and we pull up in Mercedes and Lexuses, and they pull up in turtle tops with 16 people in them. Why do you want to do that? And I was like, man, I couldn't really explain to them how much I loved it. So I would just say, let me just try it. I just want to see what it's about.
Let's talk about another one of your tracks. I want to play Hard Knock Life, which really surprised me when I first heard it, because you sample the song Hard Knock Life from the Broadway show Annie, which I thought was a real surprise, surprising choice.
To say the least.
For you, yes, to say the least. So how did you decide to use that?
Well, what happened was my sister's name is Andrea Carter, and we call her Annie for short. So when the TV version of the play you know, it came on, and it was like this a story called Annie. I was immediately drawn to it, of course, because it's my sister's name. Like, what is this about? So, I watched it, and I was, you know, I was immediately drawn to that story. And, you know, those words, instead of treated, we get tricked. Instead of kisses, we get kicked. It immediately resonated with me. So, you know, fast forward, I'm on the Puff Daddy tour, and I'm about to leave stage, and a DJ by the name of Kid Capri plays this this track, no rap on it, just the instrumental. It stopped me in my tracks. It immediately brought me back to my childhood and that feeling. And I knew right then and there that I had to make that record, and that, you know, people would relate to the struggle in it and the aspiration in it as well.
So let's hear the song, and then we'll talk a little more about it. So this is Hard Knock Life, Ghetto Anthem by Jay-Z.
Take the bass line out. Uh-huh. Jiggle. Uh-huh. Bounce. Yeah. Let it bump.
It's a hard knock life for us. It's a hard knock life for us. Instead of treat us, we get kicked. Instead of kisses, we get kicked. It's a hard knock life.
From standing on the corners bopping to driving some of the hottest cars New York has ever seen. For dropping some of the hottest verses rappers ever heard. From the dope spot with the smoke block clinging the murder scene. You know me well from nightmares of a lonely cell. My only hell, but since when y'all know me to fail? Nah, we all my niggas with the rubber grips or shots. And if you with me, mama, rubber your and whatnot. I'm from the school of the hard knocks. We must not let outsiders violate our blocks. And my block, let's stick up the world and split it 50-50. Uh-huh, let's take the dough and stay real jiggy. Uh-huh, let's sip the Chris and get pissy-pissy. Flow infinitely like the memory of my nigga Biggie. Baby, you know it's hell when I come through. The life and times of Sean Carter, Volume 2.
It's the Hard Knock Life.
That's Hard Knock Life, Ghetto Anthem by my guest Jay-Z, who has a new book called Decoded. So you tell a great story in the book about how you got the rights to use that song, to use the song from Annie, Hard Knock Life. Would you tell the story?
Yeah. we got the rights already, so it's a bit late. So, because I exaggerated a touch. You know, and it's typical when you have to clear a song, you have to send it, a sampled song, you send it to the original writers and they grant you permission and you pay a fee for that permission. You know, but some writers, their art is, for them, very important. So it has to be the right sort of attitude and the right take, and the emotion on the record has to fit, you know, what was originally intended. So we were having difficulties clearing the sample, and I wrote a letter about how much it meant to me, you know, what it meant to me growing up, and how I went to, like, a Broadway play, which was an exaggeration. I saw it on TV, and, you know, we got the rights.
Let me stop you, because in the book you say that you told a big lie. In the book you say that you made up that you entered an essay contest, and in the essay you wrote about the importance of seeing Annie on Broadway, which you'd never seen on Broadway, in fact. And, you know, all that it meant to you when you saw it on Broadway. I think you say you, like, won the essay contest. And so
I didn't want you to put the whole thing out there. I was trying to, you know, I could have.
So in other words, you lied a little bit in order to get the rights.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was a bad lie for a good reason.
Well, it worked out well for everybody.
Yeah.
Have you ever met Charles Strauss, who wrote the music for the song?
No, but someone just reached out, like, the other day and said that he wants to speak with me, so I'm going to reach out to him. Just the other day as well, so which is really cool. I was in a house trying to I went looking at a house on the Upper East Side, and I saw this plaque on the wall. And I'm like, wait a minute, that's my plaque. And it was his house. This is a couple years back. I have to share that with him.
Oh, you mean your Grammy? Is that what you're talking about?
No, the plaque for the record, you know.
The gold record plaque. The gold record plaque. Yeah. Okay.
It was like a lot of times platinum, though. But yeah, that.
That's funny. That's right. Well, yeah. I interviewed him a few years ago. You want to hear what he had to say about Annie?
Yes, please.
Yeah, okay.
Please.
I mean, about Hard Knock Life? Okay. So this is Charles Strauss, who wrote the music for Annie, talking about Jay-Z's version of Hard Knock Life. And here's what he had to say about it.
He said something in the liner notes that it was gritty. He said it was gritty, and he felt that that was the way black people felt in the ghetto. And the fact is, when we were working on Annie, it was the first song that I had written the music for. And I wanted that song to be gritty. I didn't want it to be a fake. I wanted it to show these desperate times and these maltreated girls, et cetera, et cetera. So when he picked up on that, I was very proud of myself for that reason alone.
Okay, so he liked
it. Absolutely.
No, I just have to ask you, I'm sure you've been asked this a lot, but this is the bitch and hoe question. It just always seemed to me that so much about rap music, about men's rap music, is about, you know, demanding respect, but not giving a whole lot to women in the lyrics. And I'd be interested in your take on that.
A lot of these albums are made when, you know, artists are pretty young, 17, 18 years old. So they've never really had any real relationships. And if you come, you know, in the neighborhoods we're in, you know, we have low self-esteem ourselves, you know, and then the women and, well, the girls, they have low self-esteem as well. So these are all dysfunctional relationships at a very young age. And the poet is really just pretty much saying his take on how his dealings with girls at that time. He's not in really stable relationships. He's on the road. He's seeing girls who like him because he makes music. They have spend one night together. He gets a phone number. He leaves to the next town and does the same thing, you know, over again.
No, you're talking about yourself here too, when you were younger?
Yeah, as well, yes.
Mm-hmm. So do you feel like you got over that eventually, that you matured out of that?
Of course, yeah.
And were there times when you continued to write in the character of that younger person?
I mean, a song on my first album was Ain't No I guess y'all could bleep that out. You know, and it was like this careless relationship. And then that went to Big Pimpin' in 99. And on that same album was a song called Song Cried. And Song Cried became Bonnie and Clyde on 2004. Which became Venus versus Mars on my last album. So there's a steady growth in the conversations that's being had as it pertains to women, you know, as I grew.
Can I ask you a question you might find weird, but since part of your goal in the book is to kind of explain your generation and explain the music to people. You know how a lot of hip-hop artists, when they're on stage, they kind of like grab their crotch?
Yeah, I have a great explanation for that.
Yeah, like how did that start? Like who started that and why? Why is that?
Well, a lot of times in hip hop, like in rock and roll, you'll have bands who tour the world. They get in vans and they tour the world and they do rinky dink clubs and get bottles thrown at them. And, you know, until they hone their craft, until they become, you know, rock stars. In hip hop, the music leads first. So you have a hit record and then you throw this person on stage who's never been on stage before, you know, because the music leads. So they don't have any experience on how to perform in front of people, hold the mic, you know, all these different things that you need to know as a performer. So when you get up there, you feel naked, right? So when you feel naked, what's the first thing you do? You cover yourself. So that bravado is an act of, I am so nervous right now and I'm scared to death. I'm going to act so tough that I'm going to hide it. And I have to grab, you know, my crotch. That's just what happens.
I thought it was kind of the opposite, like, this stuff is so good. I'm going to show off.
That's
no?
Yeah, they want you, that's what we want you to believe. But the reality is, and no one else will admit to this, maybe they will, is you're on stage in front of, now with summer jams and things like that, people are getting put on stage in front of 50,000 people with a record that's a radio hit and they've never performed before. It's going to be a disaster 9 times out of 10.
So do you feel like you were on stage before you prepared for it? Probably not, because you did parties before that. You had experience.
Exactly. I kind of went went through a rock and roll stage. You know, I kind of was doing parties and learning to perform. The first show I ever did, I just forgot the words. I stood there and I tried to pass the mic to Damon Dash, who I co-founded Rockefeller with. I gave him the mic like, here. He was like, man, I don't rap. I just didn't know what to do. I was in shock.
So, but really, like, you've done the crotch thing too, right?
Of course.
So why are you doing it? You're not afraid to be on stage.
Yeah, I just told you. When I first performed, I was
okay.
I forgot the words.
Okay.
I didn't do it my last show at Yankee Stadium, no. But yeah, but my earlier shows, yes.
So let's get another song in here, and let's do 99 sure. Problems. We'll do the clean version.
Ah,
it's radio, my friend. So this is actually based on a story, loosely based on a story that happened to you. Would you explain?
Well, it's based on a generational story as well. There's a higher thing. Like there was a time where there was a lot of activity going on Turnpike from New York headed south because there was a lot of drugs going back and forth, and so the state troopers at that time just blanketed every single car, anybody that was of color. And it was this term, driving while black. And people were getting pulled over for absolutely no reason, you know, other than their color. So I just had to set the scene up. So now we're driving and we're actually doing something bad. You know, we're transporting drugs from New York to, you know, down south. And we get pulled over by a state trooper, but we get pulled over for absolutely nothing. We're wrong. The cop is wrong. This conversation ensues, and it's racial undertones. And he says, do you have a gun on you like a lot of you are? You know, just that statement right there. And the conversation between two people are both in the wrong, but are both used to get in their way. So there's this clever banter that goes back and forth between the two.
Okay, and we're going to hear the part of the song that deals with the story that you just told. And
yeah.
Again, it's the clean version, so a lot of the words are going to sound kind of...
It's the second verse.
Yeah. And I will say that one of the words that isn't clearly said here because it's distorted because it's the clean version is the word bitch, which in the context of this part of the song means dog because you're talking about canine dogs here.
Yeah.
That was
the writer in me being provocative, because that's what rap should be as well, you know, at times. That was really directed to all the people who hear buzzwords in rap music. They hear bitch or ho or something and immediately dismiss everything else that, you know, takes place. And everything has to be put in context. And when you put it in context, you realize that I wasn't calling any female besides a female dog a bitch on this song.
You know, is that in spite of the opening part that says, if you're having girl problems, I feel bad for you, son. I've got 99 problems, but the bitch ain't one.
Yeah, that was to lead the listener down the wrong path if you were looking for that sort of thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
So here's 99 Problems by my guest Jay-Z.
Hit me. Yeah, it's 94 and my trunk is raw. In my rear view mirror is the mother. Got two choices, y'all. Pull over the car or bounce on the devil, put the pedal to the floor. And I ain't trying to see no highway chase with Jake. Plus, I got a few dollars, I can fight the case. So I pull over to the side of the road, I heard. Son, do you know I'm stopping you for? Cause I'm young and I'm black and my hat's real low. Do I look like a mind reader, sir? I don't know. Am I under arrest or should I guess some more? Well, you was doing 55 in the 54. Uh-huh. Lost the registration and step out of the car. You carrying a weapon on you, I know a lot of you are. I ain't stepping out of the door, my paper's legit. Well, do you mind if I look around the car a little bit? Well, my glove compartment is locked, so is the trunk in the back. And I know my rights, so you gon' need a warrant for that. Aren't you sharp to attack? You some type of law or something, somebody important or something. I ain't past the bar, but I know a little bit enough that you wanna legally search my shit. We'll see how smart you are when the K-9 comes. I got 99 problems, but a bitch ain't one. Hit me! 99 problems, but a bitch ain't one. If you having girl problems, I feel bad for you, son. I got 99 problems, but a bitch ain't one. Hit me!
That was 99 Problems by my guest, Jay-Z. Do we have time for the other 98 problems?
No. Well, I think you get it in 9 minutes.
So, part of that story is that the cops' canine corps was supposed to be coming after you. They let you go just before the dogs came?
Yeah. I guess it was far away on another call, and the cop tried to hold us. He really had no probable cause, no reason to hold us, so he just said, man, get out of here. And as we left about 10 minutes up the ride, we see this car, sirens blaring, screeching down, and we look on the side and we see K-9 unit, and we just all just a little sigh of relief, like, that was close.
Because you were holding, so it was very close.
Yeah, if K-9 would have came, we would have smelt it and we would have been finished. It would have, no book.
Right. Yeah, no, lots of things. Jay-Z, it's been really great to talk with you. Thank you so much for talking with us.
I had a great time. Thank you.
Jay-Z recorded last month after the publication of his book, Decoded. Coming up, James Murphy. His band LCD Sound System's latest album is on the 10 best lists of Rolling Stone and Pitchfork. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's continue our end-of-the-year series featuring some of our most entertaining interviews from 2010 with James Murphy, the leader of the band LCD Sound System, a band which sometimes is really just Murphy, using instruments, electronics, and overdubbing. LCD Sound System plays dance music, and Murphy used to be a club DJ, but the lyrics of his songs are often ironic and funny, and the music that inspires him goes way beyond dance music. In a New Yorker profile of Murphy, music critic Sasha Frere Jones wrote, quote, LCD Sound System helped reintroduce dance music into indie rock, blurring the lines effectively enough to bridge the divide between fans who probably don't otherwise like dance music and those who put on LCD records only to dance to, unquote. The group's 2007 album, Sound of Silver, was on NPR's list of the top albums of the decade. LCD Sound System's latest album, This Is Happening, was on the 10 best lists of Rolling Stone and Pitchfork. Murphy says it will be his final album under the name LCD Sound System. Here's a track from that album called Drunk Girls, co-written by Murphy and featuring him on vocals, drums, synthesizers, guitar, bass, Wurlitzer, tambourine, and claps. That's Drunk Girls from LCD Sound System's new album, This Is Happening. My guest is James Murphy, who is not only the founder of the band, he is most of the band. James Murphy, welcome to Fresh Air. So the band is called LCD Sound System, and you used to create sound systems.
Yes.
And your record label was called DFA,
DFA Records,
which stands for Death From Above, which is also what you called your sound system because it was all about loud.
Yes,
really loud. And why does really loud appeal to you, and how loud are we talking?
Okay. I don't like hurting ears. I don't like hurting people's ears. I don't like hurting my own ears. And there are frequencies that I find that I'm hypersensitized to, and I think people normally are. The human voice likes to hover around 1,000 hertz. you know, you can go up to 20,000 and go down to 20 hertz. And, you know, that's kind of the range of human ring. That's kind of the area where we listen in. So I like to make sure we're not punishing anybody in these frequencies that hurt your ears. But I do like the visceral physical experience of bass when it's attached to the rest of the sounds. The first shows I saw were really bodily loud. And it was a really incredible experience for me. Like your adrenaline goes up. You kind of have a fight or flight experience that can be maintained in a nice way by volume. And I think like a certain type of airy treble, a certain type of airy space that doesn't hurt your ears again is kind of wonderful and magical and for lack of a less hackneyed and overused term, psychedelic. Volume is a big part of that. I think a lot of people have lost the art of using volume in a way that isn't just harsh and painful, but it's something that I'm really into.
And you don't think you're hurting your ears?
I still test better than average. I still test really high frequency. It can be fatiguing. You know, we shouldn't do more than 5 shows in a row. But if it doesn't feel right physically, I would just be thinking constantly on stage.
You'd be thinking, oh, it's not loud enough, it's not loud enough, or?
I would just be thinking. I'd just turn my brain back on. I need the,
oh, I see.
For me,
so
I need a certain amount of volume to turn the brain off.
Right, right.
Turn the rattling monkey in my head off.
You worked as a DJ for how long?
I guess I started DJing, I started DJing for, you know, no money when I was 29, and around the same time as starting the DFA Records in New York. So DFA was a party, and I started DJing just at my own party. I didn't do it at other places. Nobody hired me. I hired myself.
So how did DJing at your own parties contribute to your approach as a composer? Because certainly when you're DJing, you're looking for a groove also.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think after being in self-involved punk bands my whole life, you're thinking about what is it you want to make? Who is it you want to be? But DJing and finding dance music was much more about, it was a much more of a communication device. It was like very blatant. It's like, if people aren't dancing, you're not doing a good job. You can't make any other argument about it. And it changed making music for me because suddenly I wanted to make music. I wanted to make songs after having given up. I'd stopped being in bands when I was 26. So took 3 years off and I wanted to do it again because suddenly there was an actual quantifiable way of measuring if you were doing your job. People danced or they didn't. And if they did, you're doing your job. And if you like it and they did, then you're doing your job in an uncompromised way, which was a really nice thing to finally be able to learn.
Well, I thought we'd hear another LCD sound system recording, and this is from earlier. This is called mm-hmm. Losing My Edge, and it's one of the most famous things that you've done.
It's the first one.
Yeah, yeah. And let's hear it. I think this is like a really funny song, and I'll just say it's about somebody who thinks he's losing his edge to the kids who are coming up from behind him. And so let's hear it and then we'll talk about it. So this is LCD Sound System.
Losing my edge. I heard you have a compilation of every good song ever done by anybody. Every great song by the Beach Boys. All the underground hits, all the modern lovers tracks. I heard you have a vinyl of every Niagara record on German imports. I heard that you have a white label of every seminal Detroit techno hit, 1985, 86, 87. I heard that you have a CD compilation of every good 60s cut and another box set from the 70s. I hear you're buying a synthesizer.
So that's the first single by LCD Sound System. And my guest, James Murphy, is the creator of LCD Sound System. And I think that's just so funny. And when I listen to it, I can't help but wonder how much of this is about you and how much of it is older people who you met coming up through the ranks who were afraid that they were losing their edge. to people like you?
It's a little bit both. It's really from a specific position and time in my life, more than it is about it, where I had started DJing and I hadn't released any music. We had DFA Records and I started having – there was parties that I was throwing and I was DJing. And for the first time in my life, I was almost cool.
but not quite.
at like 29 years old, I had my first taste of like, wait, people want me to come to this party and DJ. This is very exciting for me. And then I went to a punk show, and between the bands, somebody was DJing. Now, that wasn't done. And I was like, wait, that's my thing. Like, I play records, you know. And they were playing some of the records I played, and I got really upset. I looked, and they were like 24, 23, and I was really mad. And then I started getting very embarrassed that I was getting mad, because I remembered being in a young band when I was 23 or 24 and talking to this guy who was like ancient. I think he might have been 28 or 29. And he was talking about how kids now, they don't know, the guitar sounds aren't good and things like that. And I remember just being like, oh, man, you never say that. That's such a lame thing to say. And then I caught myself doing it. And I'm like, oh, I'm saying it. But at the same time, it's true, but it's so pathetic. And it made for the easiest song I've ever written. It was the easiest song to write. The whole lyric with a couple of – I punched it in a couple of times. But I played drums and sang that song in one take. It's just – without writing anything beforehand. The only thing that I wrote was the list of songs that I yell at the end. I mean, the list of artists that I yell at the end. The whole thing was just made up because it was such a fertile and embarrassing and circular set of feelings. Like, it was so easy to know what I was mad about and so easy to be embarrassed by it. And so, you know, it was just like endlessly like, oh, but, you know, type of emotion that I had. So it was a really, and after that I was overconfident. I was like, I can write songs all the time. This is easy. just have an experience that typifies your life at that moment and then go yell about it.
It's funny because I kind of half imagined you taking like having this secret notebook in which you wrote down all the things that people said to you about why they were worried about younger people coming up and replacing them. No, why they were losing their edge, because it's all so perfect.
It was so simple to me. It like seemed like such a good, and at the end, the reason I yell all the band names was I suddenly realized, this is what you do when you know things. Knowing things, knowledge, or like your attachment to them, or your self-association with other bands or with books or whatever, is usually like this, often this weird amulet that protects you. Like, you're like, no, I am serious. Look at my library. Listen to this. Like, I'm going to list all the books I've read, and now you know I'm a serious person. And so it was just supposed to be like this amulet swinging around me to protect me from being seen as anything that I didn't want to be seen as.
So you've mentioned several times that you like really physical music. You like to feel it in your body. So I guess it's no surprise that your first instrument was drums.
My first instrument was guitar.
Oh, so it is a surprise.
I was a singer guitar player as a kid, a.k.a. I was a self-important, pretentious jerk as a kid. And controlling, you know, teenager. I started playing guitar when I started my first band. I was 12, 13. All through high school, I played guitar, and I moved to New York when I was 19, and started feeling like maybe the guitar wasn't for me. I met a guy who was a really great guitar player. He was a natural guitar player. This guy named Yotaka Yokoyama, who was a violinist, who picked up guitar, and we liked a lot of the same music. We played together, and watching him play guitar made me realize that maybe I'm not playing the right instrument for me, because he was just so natural and physical. And I was always trying to struggle to get the guitar to give me more of something. And then I started playing drums, and I was like, oh, these are great. You hit them harder and they get louder. This is all this all really makes sense. And so I started being a drummer in bands. I think now I've settled on that the instrument is most appropriate for me is the bass guitar, because it's somewhere between the two. It's like the workhorse, and you can play it very physically, and it delivers a lot more like punch in the stomach. But it also can drive the song around. It's a rhythmic instrument, but it's also a melodic instrument, or at least a tonal instrument.
I want to play another song, and this is also an earlier LCD Sound System track, and it's the title track of your album, Sound of Silver. And I just think the lyrics are really interesting about being nostalgic for being a teenager until you remember what it was really like to be a teenager. So why don't we hear it, and then we'll talk about it.
Sound of Silver, talk to me. Makes you want to feel like a teenager until you remember the feelings of a real live emotional teenager. then you think again. Sound of Silver, talk to me, makes you want to feel like a teenager. Until you remember the feelings of a real live emotional teenager, then you think again. Sound of Silver, talk to me, makes you want to feel like a teenager. Until you remember the feelings of a real live emotional teenager, then you think again. Sound of Silver, talk to me, makes you want to feel like a teenager. Until you remember the feelings of a real live emotional teenager, then you think again. Sound of Silver, talk to me, makes you want to feel like a teenager. Until you remember the feelings of a real live emotional teenager, then you think again.
LCD Sound System. My guest is James Murphy, who's the creator of the band and plays most of the instruments on the records and does the vocals and writes the songs. So is this a kind of personal song for you?
Yeah, but in more ways than one, possibly. The type of singing is the most personal and embarrassing part of that song. I was really into Heaven 17 as a kid, too, like New Wave stuff. And the singing's kind of like arch. People don't really sing like that anymore, kind of like this kind of like 80s new romantic baritone. And I really love it. And I've been on a quest for this almost the length of this band to just trust my taste even when it's pretty embarrassing, because embarrassment's kind of an all right, untapped rock emotion. Usually people don't get too into embarrassment. They get into heartbreak and cool, but they don't get too much into just being embarrassing. So yeah, I just wanted to belt it out in this kind of weird way.
And what was your real live emotional life as a teenager?
I led a pretty okay school time. I was just I kind of made things difficult for myself. Like when I was younger, I fit in a lot better. I was an athletic kid and I was a pretty big kid. But then when we got about 13, I had much older brothers and sisters, and certain types of like hyper self-aware stuff happened to me pretty young. My voice changed when I was in fourth grade. I was 10. I looked bigger, you know, and something happened where I was not kind of on the same page as a lot of my peers. And watching the cruelty develop around 12, 13 was super psychically like traumatic for me. Of course, now it's like, oh yeah, people are kind of crappy to each other sometimes. You can live with that. It's okay. But at the time, I had no experience of this. So watching suddenly two friends that were best friends the year before turn into cliques, and you know, the more popular of those two would be taunting the less popular of his ex-best friend, and just all that stuff was just like, you know, I felt like I was in some sort of horrifying, you know, psychedelic nightmare that I couldn't wake up from. And it really, really traumatized me in a way that I find kind of embarrassing, because of course it's all just predictable stuff that everybody goes through. But I think you're supposed to be I think the blessing is at that age you're pretty oblivious to a lot of it, and so wrapped up in it that you don't, you know, like you're kind of missing the horror. And I didn't have that luxury, and it was not nice to watch.
James Murphy is the founder of the band LCD Sound System. His latest album is called This Is Happening. Our interview was recorded in June. We'll close today with music by pianist, composer, and educator Billy Taylor. He died Tuesday at the age of 89. He not only played good music, he introduced many people to jazz through his jazzmobile, his teaching, and his radio shows. He hosted a jazz show at WLIB in New York in the 60s. On NPR, he hosted the concert series Jazz Alive and Jazz at the Kennedy Center. This is a 1996 recording of his best-known composition, I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our thanks to Nicole Cohen at NPR, who's been handling our website while Melody Kramer is on vacation. Sue Spolin directed today's show. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross. I'll have the day off tomorrow, so I want to take this opportunity to wish you a happy and healthy new year.